We are, of course, pleased to have sitting with us this morning Judge Eagles, and we are ready to proceed with our first case, Feimster versus Mountain State Blue Cross Blue Shield, number 11-2256. Mr. Harmon, you may proceed whenever you're ready, sir.
May it please the court. Your Honor, I am Roy Harmon, and together with my co-counsel, Mr. Mihalik, we represent the appellants in this matter, a group of employees who are claiming COBRA coverage and some related issues arise in this case, not actually before the court today. If I may, before I begin, just touch on the procedural posture of the case this morning and a couple of facts that I think are pertinent. This order below arose from a motion for partial summary judgment, which the appellants had filed on the issue of whether COBRA applied in this case, which involves a small employer claim of exemption. That motion was met by a cross motion by the appellees. After that filing, which was, we filed August 29th, the cross motion was filed September 30th. At some later point, October 17th, the appellees filed a motion for a protective summary judgment in which they raised additional issues as to counts 3 and 4 about breach of fiduciary duty, statute of limitations, some things that had been raised earlier and had been deemed moot by the court based on an amended complaint. We never had a chance to respond to that. So to the because the judge
none of that is before the court today, is it?
Well, it's in the appellee's brief,
and it's not before the court.
No, sir,
today.
And that's my point. Okay. I'd like to just point out that we feel that the order today and the issue before the court is limited to the questions of in the order. Essentially, does COBRA apply, and the context of the small employer exemption? Now to the factual matters. This case is. Based on affiliate service group issue. We're looking at section 2B. We are not arguing any other part of the affiliate service group rules today. So that's the limit of what we're claiming. In that context, we have a very unusual trust, a so-called or claimed or sensible charitable trust, which filed tax returns as such, but actually distributed all its income to an entity that was not a 501c3 entity, that is the RMS defendant. Ultimately, it would distribute all of its assets to the same entity, despite the rules against private annuity in the trust instrument and in the Internal Revenue Code. Now, we're not here to litigate the issues of the rightness or wrongness of that, but what we are wanting to point out is that when the district court focused on the issue of asset versus interest, we believe the judge elevated form over substance by failing to look at just what kind of trust we were dealing with here. The background of this is that Mr. Mitchell, who ran RMS and actually with his attorney and family dominated the board of this so-called charitable trust, also dominated a foreign trust, Cook Islands, that was a sole member of RMS, the service organization that serviced the trust. A GAO report had come out in November of 2007, criticizing the operation of one of Mitchell's schools, one which had been bought by Salesium, and which you can tell by reading it, it's case 5 in the GAO report, which is in the joint appendix. According to the GAO, this school, the Elder School, was going to be shut down, but the owner said they would change ownership of the school. So this is Aldridge Academy, purchased some about 2006. Now, the only thing that I can see is the reason they use this charitable form was to buffer Mitchell in applying for a license for a second school in the state of West Virginia, this being the Greenbrier Academy. But they never intended to run it as such. What we wanted to focus the district court on was that when we look at the affiliate service group rules, where a service corporation, a first service entity, performs services for a second organization, which here would be RMS, that also performs services for that first organization, can be an affiliate service group. And here we argue it is.
Well, it there a dispute as to whether or not it's Solacium providing the services as opposed to RMS?
Your Honor, Solacium, I believe the appellees would admit, provided services to RMS. There's an agreement, administrative services agreement, which also has an option in it to, in favor of Solacium to purchase the assets of RMS. That lists the number of services that Solacium performed for RMS, and there's an exhibit to that same agreement that lists those: accounting, payroll, monthly bank reconciliation, the very kind of things that a service corporation would be expected to do.
Well, then my question would be, what services does RMS provide to Solacium?
All right, and that raises the issue of this trust. The charitable trust, which RMS had also a services contract with, its sole asset was the Greenbrier Academy School, which Solacium had in their 2006 acquisition documents of Mitchell's Prior School. They had agreed that they would have an option to purchase the Greenbrier School when it was developed. So RMS is working to develop the school for this trust. This trust is essentially subject to this management contract of RMS, which conveys RMS the right to all of the income and all of the principal of this trust. The district court found as much. Our point is this: the judge made a mistake when he said an interest is different than an asset. Solacia may have had an option to acquire the assets of RMS, but that doesn't include an option to acquire the trust, because that would be an interest, and that's for an asset. We're saying the asset is an interest, and it is so because of the bogus charitable trust form. A charitable trust is not designed to have income beneficiaries. It's not designed to have remaindermen. Because the defendants use that form, the only actuarial interest in this trust were in the management contract, so-called. Let's look beyond the names. This is a most unusual management agreement. What kind of commercially reasonable arrangement would have a company paying 100% of its income and allowing the management company to take 100% of its assets? That's no management agreement. What that does is it allows RMS to siphon off the income of that trust, which they did, and dumped it back out to the Cook Islands Trust, and it's shown on their tax returns. And ultimately, once this deal blew up with Solacium, because the GAO report came out in November of 2007, they call Mitchell out to Dallas, and the CIC investment folks cashiered him, and that ends their relationship. But make no mistake, before that report, they had contemplated buying that school since 2006. And if you'll notice the 2007 administrative services and option, it supersedes, note this, supersedes prior agreements, because they had known all along. And the testimony...
Mr. Harmon, if you're right about all of that, how does the option... how do you get around the nature of the option here?
Nature of option meaning...
These are all non-stop corporations and LLCs and partnerships and trusts, right?
Right.
And so you don't have any option to purchase stock here.
Well, that's correct. However, under the affiliated service group rules, if you look down to how they deal with constructive ownership, they say you will use the principles of Section 318. See, what they're saying is they're not limiting affiliate service group rules to just the corporate environment. People have a very easy way around that.
But the revenue ruling on which you rely is very specific, is
well,
it not?
Yes, sir. The revenue ruling dealt with a stock situation, but all the really the point of the revenue ruling on the law point was that a delayed effective date does not change the fact that the option holder has a unilateral right to acquire the asset. That's, I think, the point for which we were citing that.
I understand that, but as I at least preliminarily understand the revenue ruling, it's limited to options to purchase stock.
Those were the facts, Your Honor. What we would say here is, however, 414M, if the actual code reference for dealing with affiliate service group rules, which deals with many different situations than just corporations, says that the constructive ownership principles will be applied using the principles of Section 318. Furthermore, in the proposed regulations, it's clearly stated that the constructive ownership rules will apply to partnerships, not just corporations. So the affiliate service group rules regulations themselves say that the situations in which constructive ownership will be imputed will go beyond just corporate situations, include partnerships.
But their option was all or nothing. It was not a part interest or an interest in a particular entity. It was an all or nothing option, wasn't it?
The Salesium option to acquire the RMS assets?
Right.
Well, after November 15, 2011, they had a one-year period to acquire basically what would be this intangible asset, because that is the thing that RMS owned. That's really all it had. It had the rights to access the income and principal of this trust. Before that, they had the same right with a slight adjustment to the formula, and that would be that if it was 5.75 times basically earnings before tax, or $250,000, whichever greater. However, even then, Salesium would have had the unfettered right at its election to force the sale of the RMS assets, which would include this contract, which was the sum of the actuarial interest of this trust. Again, there's no income beneficiary of this trust. There's no remainderment of this trust. If you have a contract, whatever we call it, which is basically a straw or by which you can extract the income and principal of trust, that's what an income and principal interest would be in a trust. If it's all in this contract because we've got a charitable trust, which though filed with the Internal Revenue Service and represented the state of Virginia as a tax-exempt trust, a 501c3, in complete abuse of the form, its charitable trusts don't have those kind of beneficiaries. There's no actuarial interest in a charitable trust. It's supposed to be for charitable purposes. In this case, it was used by the defendants to control the Greenbrier Academy School income and its asset. So RMS used the management contract, this intangible asset, to basically control the income and principal of this trust. So
how does that give Salesium a constructive ownership in the academy?
Well, because an option to acquire the actual interest of a trust is deemed to be ownership for purposes of the affiliate service group rules. Option attribution. In the Internal Revenue Service view of the world, the way Congress looked at it, they didn't want to have people defeat real economic interests by the use of options. So it was the judgment of Congress that when you hold an option to acquire an asset, you are deemed for constructive ownership purposes as owning it outright. It's a technical rule, but it's the way the Congress wrote it. And it's commonly applied. And they're pretty well understood by most folks, and clearly in a situation where you have sophisticated investment folks, the myriad corporations here show just...
See, that's the problem I'm having, struggling with it. You said myriad corporations, and the only revenue ruling we have that arguably supports your position is limited to corporations.
Yes, sir, so I would submit this. The revenue ruling in this case is pertinent really only on the issue that a delayed effective date of an option is not a material factor. Because it doesn't, unlike a right of first refusal, the option holder can force the optionee to convey the asset. So that's the point of it. But clearly, if you look at the affiliate service group regulations, they don't apply just to corporations. So taking the principle for the revenue ruling and putting aside that the specific facts there were corporations, I think we need to more broadly look at the affiliate service group rules as doing what they do. They didn't provide a simple escape hatch. Well, just don't use corporations. You don't have to worry about affiliate service group rules.
Well, in order for you to prevail, you're arguing that by servicing the academy, RMS was actually servicing Salesian.
Yes, sir.
That's your argument.
Yes, sir. Because of constructive ownership. It's a technical argument, but the rules are technical. And the reason that they're technical is because folks that want to protect their assets, like these folks do, you know, they may use many different companies. And it's really not our fault that we have to present this argument this way. That Congress had to enact these rules to deal with the machinations of taxpayers and their counsel. These rules technically apply to this situation. I mean, it is just they actually apply just as we suggest.
What can you say, if you don't mind, we move on. How do you deal with the typical business day issue in this case?
Your Honor, I can do that.
That's a lot less complicated.
It is.
Constructive ownership.
I viewed it very simply at first. Typical business days can't account days when a business isn't open for business, which is what happened here. They went back the whole year. But secondly, and I'm going to run out of time. May I conclude this answer? But secondly, we have two other things. If we're going to look back at RMS throughout the history of the year, why would we not look back at Salesium as well? Because the statute says that all employers have to have less than 20 employees during the typical business days of the year. Well, all employers clearly didn't, because when you look at 414T, you got to include everybody that's in the control group. I'd also add that if you would like to just sort of get an analogy, I don't propose as controlling on this, but if you look at the final regulations under COBRA and you look at how they treat multi-employer plans, which, and this, of course, not a Taft-Hartley plan. This is not, right? But it gives you, I don't think anybody really tries this argument. I don't think that's why we don't really have any cases on it. But there's a situation when you have a large employer who may join a group of small employers. The regulations say there that COBRA applies instantly. And those are the same regulations that have the typical business day rules and all that. But it was the judgment of Congress that only small employers need to be protected from the burdens and costs of COBRA. That justification doesn't apply anymore once Walmart acquires a little company or Microsoft. It would be ridiculous to give them, based on the fact they start a company on August 1. Now, Microsoft's subsidiary doesn't have to comply with COBRA, not even the rest of that year, nor the next year, until the next year. It makes no sense. It's not in keeping with the purpose of the COBRA rules.
All right, thank you. You've reserved some time, Mr. Harmon.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Hopferer, we'll hear from you. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Sarah Hopferer. My firm is Steptoe & Johnson, PLLC. We represented the RMS defendants below. I'm appearing here today on behalf of all the defendants because Judge Goodwin's decision disposed of all the plaintiff's claims against all of the defendants. If I may kind of sketch out the underlying facts so we get a sense of where we are. We haven't mentioned the plaintiffs at all yet today. And as you see, understand how this case came about and how the issue arose. Is that something you would like to hear?
That's fine. I think we have a good handle on who
okay.
the plaintiffs are and
then
what
you probably
after.
All right. The plaintiffs' health plan coverage terminated in May of 2008. They didn't get COBRA. They claimed they were entitled to COBRA. That's where we're here. In a nutshell.
And the only reason COBRA wasn't offered is because the claim that the company didn't have sufficient number of employees.
That's correct.
To meet that requirement.
Right. Now, the statute says, and this is Congress's language, it's not mine, COBRA does not apply in a given calendar year if all employers maintaining the plan normally employed fewer than 20 employees on a typical business day in the previous calendar year. So that's the test. And the test, we have some regulations that kind of try to explain what that means. And there are regulations about how to count employees for this purpose. But it is all employers maintaining the plan. A key point here, only RMS maintained this plan. And in a multi-employer plan situation that Mr. Harmon referred to, all of the employers maintain the plan. So that gets them, so they are all employers. So what this is, if it's a single employer plan, it's that employer that maintains the plan and members of its controlled group. That is true. It is the members of control for purposes of counting employees, but RMS was the only employer that sponsored, that maintained this plan. So you count RMS and members of its controlled group.
And who are the members of its control group?
There were several. There were it's RMS, Taz Greenbrier Properties, Taz Development, the Family Trust, the Terry Ann Mitchell Family Trust, the Greenbrier Trust, L.J. Mitchell LLC, and L.J. Mitchell Inc.
But not Salatium.
Correct. And those,
the plaintiffs contend that Salatium should be counted in that group, correct?
Yes, they are. They're not saying, there was no dispute that in the court below that RMS was a member of a controlled group with fewer than 20 employees in 2007. That was undisputed, not challenged. And it was also not challenged that Salatium and its entities were also a controlled group with more than 20 employees in 2007. So the issue is, do you join RMS and Salatium? Obviously, that's the issue. And the issue, the plaintiff's argument, as Mr. Harmon indicated, is limited to the affiliated service group. There are lots of ways you can be a control group. But this is limited to affiliated service group, Internal Revenue Code, Section 414M2B. So that's the argument. Now, because Judge Goodwin's alternative holding is easier to understand and simpler, I would like to begin with that, if
where
I may.
Where we left off.
Correct.
Mr. Harmon.
Correct. So that this alternative holding assumes that by virtue of option attribution, RMS and Salatium were part of a controlled group by virtue of the administrative services agreement. The administrative services agreement was in effect for 4 months. 4 months is less than 50% of the business days of calendar year 2007. Now, Mr. Harmon says, well, you don't count the whole calendar year as RMS's business days.
Is that correct?
Not in this case. What you look at is not just, it's the RMS controlled group's business days. And the RMS controlled group, Task Greenbrier, was the only other entity that had any employees. LJ Inc. had one employee. January 1, 2007, Taz Greenbrier Properties was conducting business, and it handed off its employees to RMS in September of 2007. So the employees of the combined, that single employer, which is the controlled group, where you count them, you spread them over the calendar year.
Because why wouldn't you look back to January 1 with regard to the Salatium group?
Because
if you're treating arguendo Salatium as a part of the affiliated entities.
But only by virtue of the administrative services agreement. And that didn't come into effect until September. I'm saying Salatium and RMS were a controlled group under the plaintiff's theory for 4 months. RMS and Taz Greenbrier and LJ Inc. were a controlled group for all of 2007. And business was being conducted by that controlled group. And that controlled group is, in the words of the statute, a single employer.
Why wouldn't it be consistent with congressional purpose to look back as to both?
We don't know exactly what congressional purpose is. I understand there were particular instances of fractionalization of interest to try to avoid, say, withdrawal liability. It comes into play in lots of situations.
But isn't ERISA. Congress's purpose in COBRA to extend protection to terminated and former employees?
Yes, sir, as provided for in the statute. And it is not really reasonable to think that Walmart would buy a little company with a handful of employees, say in September of 2012, and maintain a separate plan for those people just so that they could not give those people COBRA. Walmart's going to put them into their plan.
If it saves a dollar, why not?
I'm sorry?
If it saves a dollar, why not?
Why would it save a dollar? It's expensive to maintain a plan. There are administrative expenses. You have the separate plan from the Walmart plan. Why would they do that? It doesn't make sense. And then the cost is incrementally at that level of a Walmart and a 10 employee is.
But if you've got a contract in place covering only 13 employees, and on September 1st or October 24th, you close the deal, I don't quite follow the economic incentive to do anything other than leave that little 13 participant plan in place.
I think they would probably leave it in place till the start of the next plan year.
Exactly.
And then fold everybody in.
Exactly.
The next plan year is going to be the next calendar year, so they're all going to be covered.
Right. So my question is it not consistent with congressional purpose in that situation to say, okay, Walmart, you closed the deal, you're on the hook?
But the statute doesn't say that, Your Honor. It's 20.
How does an option to purchase all the assets of RMS get them under a definition of a common control rule?
It doesn't.
All right. Now tell me why.
That's the more complicated argument. It's a little bit hard to understand, and then have to kind of pick it apart. So the argument is that there is an affiliated service group.
The trust attorneys must have earned a very large fee.
Can't speak.
And there's nothing wrong with
nothing
that.
Nothing in the record on that.
There's nothing wrong with that, by the way.
Nothing in the record on that, Your Honor. So it's an affiliated service group under 414M2B of the Internal Revenue Code. The plaintiffs say that Salesium was a first organization because its principal business in 2007 was performance of services. Well, principal business is the performance of services isn't a very helpful definition, but that's what we have. We'll assume for the sake of argument that Salesium was principal business in 2007, was providing services, so it could qualify as a first organization under the statute. Then, according to the plaintiffs, RMS is the B organization. And it can be a B organization only if a significant portion of its business in 2007 was performance of service for Salesium, the first organization. Now, Judge Goodwin noticed in his opinion, he said, well, no, wait a minute. RMS, Salesium contracted with RMS to perform services for RMS. That's the administrative services agreement, not the other way around. So the plaintiffs argued that, in fact, by RMS performing services for the trust, that Salesium constructively owned the trust, therefore RMS was providing services for trust. Is that right? I think that's where they are. Now, it is true that RMS performs services for the trust, the Greenbrier Trust. That's the management agreement. But it's not true that Salesium constructively owned the Greenbrier Trust, and here's why. We're talking about option attribution, and it is, and under the control group rules, an entity having an option to acquire an interest in another industry is treated as owning that interest. Interest is an equity interest. It is not, the statute does not say that an entity having an option to purchase assets owns the assets. Doesn't say that. It's an interest. Then the revenue ruling, it was stock, but it's equity.
There's something somewhat jarring in the proposition that an asset doesn't include an interest.
Well, okay, let's break it down. Here's how this works, I think. Now, the administrative service agreement provided that Salesium was to have an option to acquire RMS's assets for a one-year period. This is something that we haven't mentioned, beginning in September of 2011. Then RMS, by virtue of its management agreement with the trust, well, it had the authority over the trust assets, and the trust's income was paid in the form of tuitions was paid over to RMS's management fees. siphoning the revenue from the trust is not really a fair view of what this was about. It's a management agreement. RMS would come in and run the school for the trust, and the trust would pay it management fees. There's a lot of discussion of siphoning revenue from the trust to the offshore trust, but in fact, several million dollars of losses were siphoned from the trust to the offshore trust because the school didn't break even for several years. But anyway, it was the provision of the management agreement said, you will manage our school, RMS, and we will pay you 1.1 times what it costs you to manage it. As it happened, it didn't pretty much end up being tuition was paid to the trust, and then it was paid over to RMS as management fees. But services were provided for those fees. Now,
I thought you were going to tell us why INSET, as a matter of law, doesn't encompass an interest.
I'm trying to.
Okay.
Well, let me help you out on that point. The lower court reasoned that on the effective date of Solasium's option, it would not have a choice to purchase legal or equitable share of RMS, the trust, or the academy. Rather, it would have had the option to purchase all of the assets. Is that true?
All the assets, correct. No.
And how does that change?
How does
Ms.
that
Davis's
make it?
Question?
Okay.
So
we've got this, I don't know that the plaintiffs and I are in disagreement on whether that's an equity interest, but the equity interest that's in all this, that Solasium supposedly had an option to acquire, is the equity interest in the trust, which, according to the plaintiffs, by virtue of the management committee, management agreement with RMS effectively controlled the equity interest in the trust. So that equity interest, under the plaintiff's theory, is one of the assets that RMS had, and that Solasium would have been entitled to acquire if lots of other things didn't happen 4 years down the road. Of course, lots of other things did happen, and the agreement was terminated, and the option never kind of sprung into effectiveness.
But you don't dispute that an option, to exercise an option, is sufficient, or maybe you do.
I'm not sure what I'm going to understand.
The option to a future option.
If it's unconditional. If it's unconditional. This one was not. The agreement provided that it could be terminated for breach. Most agreements are. It provided that it could be terminated by agreement of the parties. It was after 4 months. So this option, it's not the option in the revenue ruling, that only the passage of time, the only contingency on its being exercisable was the passage of time. And in the world of the Internal Revenue Service, that doesn't count. It's constructive ownership. If you can do it without any other contingencies at some time down the road, we're going to treat you like you did it today.
I take it you don't rely. Have you addressed Judge Floyd's concerns sufficiently in your judgment, or I don't want to divert you from that?
Well, I guess my point was that one of these assets is an interest, and I think there's a couple of things wrong with that. And one thing is that the management agreement. It was an agreement. It was fees for services. It wasn't automatically turning over all the income. The RMS did not have a claim to the income. It had the claim to management fees. As a practical matter, it turns out to be the same thing. But I don't believe that being in a contract and being entitled to fees for services thereby gives you an equity interest in the entity that you're providing the services for. I don't think that's an equity interest. And I also think this with the assets, RMS was running the school. It had authority to purchase and sell assets of the school in connection with running the school. It doesn't give it unfettered discretion to grab the trust whenever it wanted to. All of the agreement was under the supervision and direction of the trust. And when the assets were—
You say grab the trust consisted of the school, didn't it?
That's right.
That's all?
That's right.
So it already had grabbed the trust under the management agreement.
I think it had operated the trust. It hadn't. The assets were transferred by the trust to RMS at the end of, I believe, 2008. Now that was not RMS saying RMS, in exercise of my powers under the management committee, hereby give me, RMS, the trust assets. That's how it was. The trust transferred the assets to RMS.
You don't rely on the specificity of the revenue ruling as it relates to stock. I don't think you made that argument.
I did not. But I do say it's stock. It's equity. If it's an LLC, a partnership, a proprietorship, a trust, it is an equity interest, and that's stock in that case. It was stock in that case. And I think the significance of that is that it was stock. I mean, there didn't used to be LLCs.
So you're suggesting that an LLC, in fact, as plaintiff contends, can be treated just as if it were a corporation for this purpose?
It can be treated as a partnership.
As a partnership. So a partnership interest.
Correct.
Would be enough.
An equity interest.
Why do you insist on equity interest? What other kind of interest is there in a going concern?
There isn't, because assets are not an interest. I mean,
is an interest encompassed by an asset?
It's one of the assets, in this case, was an interest. Anyway, okay.
Oh, you agree that one of the assets was an interest?
According to the plaintiffs. And I think I mentioned to the court one reason I think that's wrong is that the management agreement, because RMS was performing services in exchange for fees, didn't give RMS an equity interest in the trust. And I also believe that the fact that RMS had authority to buy and sell trust assets did not give it an equity interest in the trust.
Okay, your time is up, but if the only asset is the school, including the real property and the personalty,
actually, the trust did not own the real property and the personalty. The trust.
What did the school consist of for these purposes?
There are buildings, improvements, a physical plant,
exactly,
et cetera. Those were not owned, and those were not held in the trust name.
I understand, but those were among the assets that RMS could buy and sell. No. Why isn't that an equitable interest?
Because it's assets.
Because it's assets. So if RMS could sell a used copier owned by the school and make a tiny profit because it was fully depreciated, would that be an equitable interest in an asset of the school?
It could buy and sell assets used in the operation of the school. So,
a used
and there was
copy.
Equity left over after they sold the asset.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I would like.
You made my day. I mean, when I could ask a question that the lawyer can't answer. I've had a complete day. I should quit now.
Well, that's all. It's Miller time. I did, in closing, quickly, I just want to stress that the option was a springing option. There were lots of contingencies. It wasn't effective in 2007, and then the revenue ruling is distinguishable on that ground. It never became effective. So no matter if, you know, how many business days you count for RMS in 2000 or anything else, that option, Salesium never had an option to acquire RMS's assets, so it never had an option to acquire the trust.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Harmon, you have some time remaining.
Thank you, if I may. I'd like to just say the reason why a Walmart-type entity would do what I proposed is because there are sick people in COPRA, and they're not desirable for plans. And it wouldn't have to be Walmart, and once these opinions get out in the seminar circuit, it won't be just Walmart. It's just that I'll use that as an example, some hyperbole. I'd like to go back to the option, if I may. I really don't think in listening to this that really even counsel can sincerely defend the district court's opinion on assets being different than interest. If I have a contract that allows me to have 100% of your income and access to take your assets, which in fact RMS did in 2009 by just having the trust to sign all of it over to RMS, I don't know in what world that is not a valuable asset. It certainly would be in my world, and I think in the economic world. So to try to make this Black's Law Dictionary, Hornbook Law distinction to get in the thicket of common law, where we're really dealing with very precise notions in the Internal Revenue Code, I think is just a huge mistake. And it allows this kind of manipulation of form, such that you have rank and file folks segregated off into one company, where Mitchell and his family, who are on the payroll of different companies, and they have their insurance. The Mitchell son and his daughter-in-law, they were actually held positions at RMS. Mitchell was the CEO. They all had their insurance through their different Solacium subsidiaries. It's just the rank and file folks that don't get their insurance, which is the very reason that these laws were enacted. Now, let me go to the option just a minute, because I want to point out that this is not a bilateral contract as the option. The option agreement is here in the record. It's Joint Appendix 764. 1.1 says that the provisions of Article 3 and 4 shall survive termination of this agreement. Solacium wasn't giving up their option to protect their investment. And when you look at the option, it isn't just a one-year period after November 15, 2011. If you read each sentence, the following sentence says that they will also have the option before that date to purchase the school for the greater of 5.75x of the company's trailing earnings, or $250,000. So this idea that's out there somewhere, it is out there, but there's also a warrant that precedes that. The right of first refusal terminated on November 14, 2007. If you read carefully, you'll note that only until November 14 was the right of first refusal. So the idea that there's some sort of contingencies on this option, totally misplaced, not justified in the record. And going back to where
your point is that they were ephemeral contingencies or illusory contingencies.
Really, the right of first refusal, which was raised for the first time on this appeal, having recognized that the delayed effective date wasn't working for them because of the revenue ruling, and we both agree, it's not stock doesn't matter. It could be any interest. But point is that they needed something else, so they think, well, you know what, it's a part of the bilateral contract. The problem is you read closely, and this option is specifically designated as surviving. Then they think, well, maybe we can argue there's a right of first refusal. But the right of first refusal expired November 14. So, and even then, I can interpret, that, which probably you should, consistent with others, to say, well, if the right of first refusal was for less, then Solacium had the right to exercise, to take that price rather than what might have been a greater option price. But at no time did Solacium not have the unfettered right to acquire the assets of this trust.
Let's assume that the interest asset distinction is not solid. So that leaves us with having to deal with counting days.
Yes, sir.
Don't insert Walmart in the example. Deal with what we've got here.
Okay. I would submit that the rules, as the court has noted, are designed for the protection of employees and to expand coverage, not to contract it. And the rules are not to be read in such a rigid way that you would count the small employer's pedigree and not look at the large employer's pedigree, because when the rules say all employers maintain the plan, it specifically incorporates control group. You cannot read that out. You got to go to the rules in 414T, specifically incorporated COBRA, and you got to look at all employers. If that weren't true, then again, without using Walmart, any company that had over 20 employees could be running little subsidiaries all over the place with less than 20, and the COBRA wouldn't apply. But the control group rules defeat that, and they defeat that here. This trust had no employees. Well, I mean, the district court found that. Basically, Salesium was letting Mitchell develop this school for ultimate purchase, just like they did Aldridge. We got a picture of how this, it's just replay 2006 when they bought the Aldridge Academy. They did the same thing there. Test the waters, but they got the option, and that's the got you under the code. They had the option. They deserved to be caught on it because they were literally holding these people out of a plan that they should have been running just like any other subsidiary of Salesium. The only difference here is they used a cockamamie fraudulent charitable trust, which apparently didn't arch an eyebrow in the court below. But in my opinion, that's probably where we should start and just ignore this trust and recognize that Salesium was developing an asset that they were going to acquire were it not for that GAO report that intervened in late November 2007.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harmon.
Thank you.
The matter is submitted. I can assure counsel, at least speaking for myself, this case clearly had the potential to give a judicial headache of the highest order, but your presentation today avoided that risk.
I'm glad I didn't make your day twice.
We will come down and greet counsel and then proceed immediately to the next case.